Hello and welcome to Blind Line, the original interactive talk show exclusively for the blind and vision impaired. My name's Jonathan Mosen and it's Sunday, the 8th of December 2002 today. Good to have you along. It was 22 years ago today, by the way, that John Lennon was assassinated outside the Dakota Building in New York. So maybe if you're a Beatles fan like me, you might take some time to put on a Beatles album or two, or a Lennon Ono album, and remember that wonderful legacy of music that he's left us. On the program today, though, we're going to be talking once again about the Stephanie Doman complaint, which has, of course, been joined by Guide Dog Users Incorporated, an affiliate of the American Council of the Blind. Stephanie Doman alleges she was discriminated against in violation of federal law by her being turned away with her guide dog on the 5th of June of this year from the Iowa Department for the Blind when she went for a rehabilitation program. Now, firstly, we're going to be speaking with the director of the Iowa Department for the Blind, Alan Harris, and then we'll speak with Chris Gray, the president of the American Council of the Blind, about some of the internal issues that this raises in terms of the different perspectives on this issue taken by two affiliates of the council, GDUI and the Iowa Council of the United Blind, or ICUB. The program is recorded today. That's not because neither of the guests were prepared to take calls. It's actually because I'm unable to do the program live today. So, Alan Harris, who was unable to join us last week because he didn't get my email, he was taking a bit of an extended Thanksgiving break, responded very quickly as soon as he did get the email. We had a very swift interchange of mail and were quickly able to organise a time when we could record this interview. Alan Harris, welcome to the program. Can I confirm that, from your perspective, it's accurate to say that Stephanie Doman was indeed turned away from the department on the 5th of June because she was accompanied by her guide dog?
Jonathan, thank you for the welcome. Let me begin by saying I am not in a position to comment on a specific case or a specific individual. The nature of confidentiality is such that while it seems like one might do it here or there, it simply doesn't work. So I'm gonna ask you not to ask me about a specific individual, but to see if we can't talk about the policies and practices at the Iowa Department for the Blind. And if you want me to answer that question in a way that says, would we turn away someone from the Iowa Department for the Blind who wanted to participate in a particular program because he or she had a dog guide? The answer is no, we would not. There is one exception, Jonathan, and it is this. We have an orientation adjustment to blindness and training program, which we refer to as our comprehensive program. It is a program that has four core requirements, and those core requirements are these. First, we teach independent and safe travel with a long white cane. Secondly, we teach the Braille code and assistive access technology. Third, we teach a variety of daily living skills, from home ec skills to household skills, a variety of things. And the final, fourth and final one is industrial arts. Those are the four core curricular areas of our comprehensive orientation adjustment to blindness and training program. And in that program, that is the only exception that exists for asking students not to participate with dog guides.
Okay, and I'd like to follow up on those issues of policy in a second. I just want to observe that it must be frustrating for you as the director of a rehab agency if a client takes a particular set of issues that are personal to them into the public domain and that you feel constrained for ethical reasons to comment on the particulars of the case. Is it not an argument that says that if somebody chooses to make their case a national and even an international media story, that that has in fact waived their right to confidentiality?
Jonathan, I think that's a theoretical argument which one can make, and which I think has some merit, but it doesn't persuade me that because an individual has taken his or her discussion to the public, that triggers for me the opportunity to ignore or to lessen our commitment to confidentiality. So while the way you ask the question certainly does strike a chord with me, the temptation is not very strong for me to do anything other than what I currently do, which is to say that I think we can have the entire discussion without talking about an individual, and I think we can get to all of the issues that are pertinent to the decisions which we have made in the past, would make today, and will make in the future until or unless someone constrains us from doing it. So I don't think it limits our ability, Jonathan, to have the discussion at all.
No, neither do I. Let's talk then about who would go on this adjustment to blindness course as a rule. I mean, it sounds like it may well be generally for those adventitiously blind who are trying to come to terms with blindness. Or are there also people who've been blind a long while who benefit from this?
It would depend on whether you've had any training. I've been blind for 50 years. If all of a sudden it occurs to me that there is something else I'd like to do, I'd like to change work, I'd like to go back and add education, which I don't possess, to my experiences, and as a result of that, I set a vocational goal that requires me to achieve a degree or a licensure certification or something of the sort. Then I may well be a good candidate for the comprehensive adjustment program at the Iowa Department because I've not had any training and I've gotten by with such that I have, and it has served me up to this point. So I think we do see individuals who at various points in their life decide that they really have, maybe they've had some vision and lost vision. Maybe they've simply resisted wanting to be blind. Who doesn't resist it at some point? And now they come to grips with it. So I think there's a fair number of people who would fall into that category. It is, I believe, accurate to say that the majority of students with whom we work are students who have lost their sight their sight or in fact become blind more recently. I'm thinking about the 18 or 20 or so students that we currently have, and probably it's about, as I look just quickly down the list here, probably 60-40 those who have lost their sight or had drastic vision loss in the last 1 to 3 years versus some who are 30 something, 40 something, 50 something. We also have what we call senior integration, Jonathan, which brings blind elderly people to our center. We have a woman here right now who will spend from 2 to 3 weeks. She's in her second week. She's 88. She's not training for any vocation. She simply has finally decided that for her, the time has come to get some comprehensive training at the center. So it would vary based on circumstances.
And how many people on average would come to you who are guide dog users to whom you have to say, please leave your dog at home if you're coming on this course?
I know. Since I've been here a little over a year, I know of two cases where I can think of two cases where there was a person who wanted to participate in programs at the department and who had dog guides. I think of one that was going to participate in the comprehensive adjustment to Blindness and Training Program, who had voluntarily made arrangements to be a day student and B, to have a family member be with a dog during the day. That was an arrangement which he made on his own and simply told us about it. He decided not to come at the last moment as a result of some health issues. That's one that I think of. In the case of a specific program, for instance, Jonathan, if you came to us and we developed a plan with you, and the plan, the individual plan for employment, which is required, said that what you needed to do in order to maintain your current employment was to get intensive, effective training over a course of 2 weeks or 3 weeks or whatever, because your company was switching hardware, changing to a different program or whatever, you would be welcome to come, and you would be welcome to come with a dog guide. There is no prohibition of any kind on participating in a program that is a part of your plan, other than the exception that we've talked about at the beginning of the program, which is the Comprehensive Adjustment to Blindness and Training Program. The same is true for our, we have a, as part of our department in the same building, we have a talking book library and Braille collection. In fact, the second largest Braille collection, Great Britain says it is larger, in the country. We have lots of patrons who come in to browse, to pick up books, and many of them are dog guide users. We have a cafe in the building which is open to the public and which many people frequent, some of whom are blind and some of whom have service dogs or dog guides. We have a Randolph Shepherd program. The same thing is true. We have 30 or so locations. I think just offhandedly of several people in that program who have dog guides. So it is, I give you those for examples. It is not a policy of the Iowa Department for the Blind to turn away people from participating in departmental programs based on the single criterion of possessing a guide dog. On the contrary, we make the arrangement and agreement with the individual, and we work out the terms of their individual program, whatever it happens to be, based on that.
So can you elaborate further for me on what specifically it is about the Comprehensive Adjustment to Blindness program that makes the presence of a guide dog inappropriate or detrimental to the outcomes of that program, in your view?
I can tell you that, let me start by saying, Jonathan, we have what we believe is an effective and successful program based on our experience. I think we are arguably among the best programs in the country, and that represents more than 40 years of experience. I think the core curriculum that we've set up is one that would not be unlike the kind of curriculum that a specialized technical school or for that matter a community college with a certification or licensure program might set up, where we have decided that there are four core areas that really build on the success of our students. Our commitment at the Iowa Department for the Blind, Jonathan, is that it is not vision that determines how successful one can be. And therefore, what we are committed to, and what I believe our core curriculum represents, is the idea that as a blind person, I have to come to accept that is the case. That is, anything we can do to provide a foundation that says, for me, Alan Harris, if I'm a student, it really is true. It is not vision that determined that I was successful in the use of the radio arm saw, or that I traveled safely and independently from our building at 4th and Keogh to West Des Moines to the mall and came back or whatever. It isn't vision really that determined that I now am matriculated in a college and am doing well or whatever. It's a commitment, Jonathan, to the idea that says we think if we can get individuals to accept that non-visual approaches to life are as effective as visual approaches, that people will not only raise their expectations, but will be in a better position to plan the kinds of things that they'd like to do. Now, let me hasten to add that there are students who complete our program at 6 to 9 months is a fairly typical period of training. And one of the first things they do when they leave is go to a school where they work to become proficient and receive a guide dog. That's a choice which I would view as an informed choice, and I don't believe that makes them any less committed to non-visual beliefs. I don't think it makes them poorer students. I don't think it reflects that we didn't do a good job. I think it represents a choice that a person has made. I guess the other thing I would say about our core curriculum is there are some limits, I think, to what what anybody does. That is, we are not a place, Jonathan, that is interested in being everything to everybody. And by that I mean, if what we wanted to do was to make you happy and everybody you know happy, who was blind or had a significant degree of vision loss, what we would do is we would have you come. We would ask you what you thought would make you comfortable, what you thought would be fulfilling to you, what you thought you could benefit from, what skills you, and you would put together a program for yourself. And I presume we could take it further, and you would look around and see who you'd like to have instruct you in those things, how much time you'd like to be involved, and we would get on with your program. Our approach to that is to say we are one iteration of a program that provides comprehensive adjustment to blindness training, and that there are other ways to do it and other methodologies that other center-based programs use, and that you are perfectly willing, based on, I assume that you have enough information. Now, this really is important for people to have the information. You make a choice to do something else. You make a choice to say, no, I'm not interested in this program. I won't wear sleep shades. That's not what I'm interested in doing. I wanna do what I do visually. I'm not interested in Braille. I wanna work with, access technology speech only. Those are choices which I think are personal and appropriate for an individual to make, but they're not choices which we are prepared to build in to our program to the extent that they would change our core curriculum.
But as the state's agency for the blind, doesn't that put your department in a particularly special position, because you're receiving quite a bit of government assistance, which surely would require the department to make sure that it doesn't adhere too rigidly to one particular worldview of rehabilitation, and that people shouldn't be required to have to go out of state to have what they perceive to be their preferred form of rehab.
Yeah, that's a point of view that I hear from time to time. And I guess, as I say, my position I expressed a moment ago, which is, Jonathan, where does one say this is overly prescriptive and in fact discriminatory, but this is okay? That is to say, how far are you prepared to go before you say this is chaotic, doesn't represent a commitment to the effective practices that we, how far are you prepared to go? Would you stop at at choice of mobility? Would you include choice of mobility, choice of literacy or no literacy? Would you go far enough to say that if a person really wanted to come and rest for most, I mean, which thing would you pick to say, no, I think that's not reasonable. This is, but that's not. I don't know that I'm prepared to pick that place, and therefore I think informed choice allows for that. Informed choice says you may find a place, if it's not at the Iowa Department for the Blind for a comprehensive adjustment and training, if it's not here, you may pick a place that suits your needs. We will work with you to write a plan. We will facilitate your participation in it, and of course, we'll pay for it. I think that's reasonable. I think it's more reasonable than trying to run a place that really says we are able and prepared to respond to whatever it is you think you want.
You see, those who have signed on to this complaint against the department are saying that before a guide dog user is considered for guide dog training by the schools, they have to prove that their cane skills are in fact adequate, because the dog could get sick or anything could happen.
Sure.
And that this should be taken into account when the department makes its policies with respect to this particular course. What's your view on that?
My view is that the dog guide schools should set up whatever criteria they think is appropriate and is effective for them, and I presume that they do. If a person says, look, what I want to do is I want to participate fully, but I want to choose my form of mobility, and I want to do it without sleep shades, and I don't want communication skills. I really stand by my point and the rhetorical question, Jonathan. Where would you draw a line? Where would you say, well, there's no such thing as too much choice, and choice means you do whatever you want. But on this issue, you really must accede to this, because this one really does matter. I don't know how you make that distinction. And if I went to a dog guide school and I said to them, I hear this is a terrific place where you could learn to get around and so forth, I'm really not sold on dogs. What I really would like you to do is to give me some training. I hear you have excellent orientation mobility dog handlers, but what I'd like to do is use a cane. I don't think that they would say to me, well, that's fine. Sure, if you'd prefer to use a cane rather than a dog, that's no problem. Or maybe I say I'd like to use both. I mean, it seems to me their program is training in the use of a guide dog. Our program includes a core curriculum that uses the long white cane. It doesn't prescribe it for one's life use. It doesn't argue that it is a superior or better form. It simply is what we have chosen as part of our curriculum. And it does not have, other than the fact that that's what we'll start you with, it does not have value which will change your life. As I said to you, we have students. I can think of two in the year that I've been here. The first thing they did when they left was they had set up arrangements to go become trained to use guide dogs. So I guess, as I say, I don't think that setting a curriculum based on effective practices denies an opportunity to someone, unless, Jonathan, there is no other way to get it. Then I believe that it is not only unfairly restrictive, but likely discriminatory. But if I am prepared to allow you the choice and support you in that choice, the fact that it's not in this building, I think, is not an issue that really has merit, that causes me anyway to feel differently about the curriculum which we require.
So your perception really is that in the case of the Comprehensive Adjustment to Blindness program, the department is offering kind of a white cane school in the same way that guide dog places offer a guide dog school?
As on the question of mobility, yes.
Right. All right. How then do people get on who want to receive a very similar program but with a guide dog instead of a white cane? The answer then is to go to another state that would offer such an option. Is that how it works?
If you want comprehensive and adjustment training, and you want all of the things that we offer, except you're not willing to take instruction with a long white cane, or you're not willing to use sleep shades, or you're not willing to take the other course, then we would, Jonathan. Let's take the guide dog business out of it, because that heats it up in a little different way. And I don't mean in any real sense we can take the guide dog business out. But I mean just put it to one side for a moment. If your issue were, I will not take Braille, I will not wear sleep shades, and I won't go into industrial arts, our position would be with you the same. You may not then participate in our comprehensive adjustment to blindness and training program. Same thing. So we have not picked guide dogs as a targeted reason for excluding anyone. We have four criteria which everybody has to agree to if they're going to come through our program. So any of the others would have the same effect as this one. It's just that if we said sleep shades, I don't know, would people say that's discriminatory and against the ADA? I suppose some do. If we said we require training, reading and writing in Braille, and you said, I don't want it, I don't mind not being literate in reading and writing in Braille, is that discriminatory? I suppose that, you know, you could make the same argument. So I say that, again, not to say the guide dog issue isn't important, but it's not more important in my mind than the other parts of our core curriculum, because we would respond the same way. We would say to you, in this program, we require these things.
But I suppose most people who know what they're talking about would argue that without Braille skills, if you have insufficient vision to read print with any degree of speed, that really one's literacy is restored through Braille and there's no other option to give you that same degree of flexibility. But in the case of guide dogs and the white cane, the argument's put forward that actually the guide dog is, if not an equal form of mobility to the cane, in some areas superior in terms of the grace and speed with which one can move around obstacles, get from one place to another. But it seems that the department is making a judgment that, in fact, a guide dog cannot be a part of a comprehensive adjustment to blindness program, and therefore perhaps it's an inferior form of mobility.
Well, two things. I have individuals who say to me, I am not illiterate because I don't have Braille and because I can't read print. I've got a computer with speech.
Well, that is true.
I have people who say to me, I am not going to do anything that requires problem solving and that requires the kind of dexterity and planning that goes into working in the wood shop or the machine shop or whatever that we require. They make the same kind of argument, Jonathan. It's not a judgment as to whether the cane is inferior to the dog. Let's assume for the moment that the dog is a superior form. It's just not part of our core curriculum, in the sense that if what we are trying to establish is my belief in the fact that non-visual techniques really do work, and as a consequence, the truth about blindness is that it is not how much or how little I see, but how skilled, how motivated, how much energy, how much education, how much of all of the assets that any person possesses, then I'm just perfectly pleased with the results. If we restricted, if this core curriculum at the Iowa Department, it limited you for your life, if it had the effect of dampening and ultimately restricting you because you were kept from knowing about guide dogs, you were prohibited, you had some agreement that we entered it, then I think it would be unreasonable, discriminatory, and certainly unethical. Anything else that you can think of, but that's not the way it happens. When you finish with our training, you are free to make whatever choices you want to make about whatever you have learned. You can use it or not. You can put your cane away and never pick it up again. You can never go near the milling machine again. You can never turn on the JAWS, you know, whatever you. So you're not. Your life has not been diminished. We have simply made some choices based on experiences, success, and effective practices that have some limitations. Every program does, Jonathan. Mm. I mean, think of a program that specializes in something that doesn't have some restrictions. They for the most part are not going to be able to say to you, if you want to train to work in some particular area, you can approach that 10 different ways, and we don't care how you do it.
But if a blind person has made those choices, in other words, they've had some cane training because they're supposed to have by virtue of
right.
having been issued with a guide dog,
right.
then effectively they have made an informed choice, but now they're being discriminated against in terms of having made that one choice. They're being barred from access to all the rest of the program that they may
yeah,
wish to...
Yeah, not at all, because and I think that's the fallacy of so much of what... I don't have the time to read lots of stuff that comes to me, but people send me stuff off of listservs, and every so often I will look at half a dozen of them, but I really don't get to see many of them. But I see the thing that says, well, if you live in Iowa and you want specialized computer training, you can't get it at the department if you have a dog. That is not true, Jonathan. If you want to do career exploration, or if you want to do some adjacent research on a personal interest that involves technology or career training, if you have a dog, you can. That is simply false, and I cannot believe, after all the time, this goes back to June. I cannot believe that continues to occupy for some people, apparently. To create obsessive behavior over what is clearly not true.
You mentioned that the course relies on the use of non-visual techniques.
Correct.
Does that mean then that the guide dog is a visual technique in a sense, in the same way that, say, sighted guide is reliance on vision?
Yeah, I hesitate, Jonathan, to say that it that sighted guide and sighted dog are the same kind of thing. I simply say that we have made a choice that the cane is what we're going to use in that piece of our core curriculum, and I don't make any comparisons or analogies beyond that. I just don't.
But presumably you'd make choices because you want to give your clients what you perceive to be the best option.
And what I think is most consistent with our commitment to a belief in non-visual techniques, that's, as I've stated several times, that's really what we're committed to. And at some point, Jonathan, maybe someone will decide that our model is a great model, but they'll take the cane out and put the dog in. They'll require people to use the dog, or they'll say whichever, it doesn't matter. Maybe that will evolve. Some center will take some effective practices that we have, modify the mobility requirement, and they'll settle on that as something closer to a good model. But we really have made our curriculum reflect what our experience, success, and effective practices have demonstrated to us. And as I say, I guess if there were anything that I am discouraged about, it is the fact that the one exception to an entire offering, a whole series of programs, is allowed to perpetuate as fact. There are no restrictions on the use of guide dogs by anyone in any aspect of training, access to or participation in programs at the Iowa Department for the Blind, except for comprehensive orientation.
I no doubt you've had legal advice on this, but what is it about the current state of federal law that doesn't actually require your department to do what you've just said, to actually allow this course to take place with a guide dog option? Because obviously there are federal laws that discriminate against.
We don't have any federal. I mean, there's been no ruling yet.
Right.
There is a federal case pending, and there is a local state case pending. So we don't have any guidance or results from those yet to tell us that the practice is acceptable or that it's not. Our own belief is that we have a right to set a program, and in the current vocational rehabilitation law, federal law, we must provide, as part of any program, choices to people who do not find the program we offer suitable to their individual needs.
I must say that there were many people who said that you would not agree to come on the program to do this interview, and I would like to ask you, because you don't get a chance to see it on the lists, something that has come up. Although the ACB and the NFB work well together on most issues, there are some differences on some prominent national issues, and also in organizational methodology and philosophy. I wonder to what extent you believe that the policies of the Iowa Department for the Blind are influenced by its strong, quite long-term federation links, because there are some who believe that this is an ACB-NFB thing.
The current curriculum, Jonathan, has been in place for 40 some years. Certainly, no one would accuse Dr. Jernigan of being anything other than a person who supported the National Federation of the Blind and whose philosophy was certainly a significant part of the Federation. Much of the philosophy, literature, and the history of the Federation certainly goes to Dr. Jernigan. He built this program, and he administered it for 20 years. So it would be silly and quite disingenuous to say that there isn't a Federation foundation to some of the program at the Iowa Department for the Blind. But for my part, it is not an ACB, NFB, anything. For my part, the decisions that I make, I have to answer to a board appointed by the governor, three people, and the blind people of the state of Iowa. And I can tell you that the history in the state of Iowa, in terms of blind people being quite capable of advocating and affecting policies, is pretty clearly established. And so I really don't see it as an organizational issue of any kind, except for the comments that I made earlier about the fact that Dr. Jernigan founded the program. Dr. Jernigan put in place the basic tenets and some of the practices, certainly, that the Iowa model and some others are based on. And so to that extent, it certainly reflects some aspects of NFB philosophy. But from my point of view, I didn't move in here, nor could I today or tomorrow pronounce that from this point on, the core curriculum or the personal practices or purchase or whatever, we're going to reflect the Federation beliefs or values or whatever. I don't have that kind of influence.
Although it would be quite difficult to distinguish, would it not, between the program that the department is providing here and the, say, the Louisiana Center or the other centers that the NFB is running?
I think there are similarities, but I think they are modeled after this one and not the other way around.
All right. As a general point of principle, do you perceive any dangers in a consumer leader, no matter which organization they're a part of, being a senior manager in a rehab agency?
I think that for me, I really have to answer to my board. I have to answer to the blind of the state of Iowa, and so for me, that's really the compass that I have to pay attention to. If I'm a good leader and I do a good job, and our customers are satisfied with the work that we do, I think I'm okay, and I don't see any conflict. I think the potential for conflict some places may exist, but here I can tell you, Jonathan, the blind of this state are not going to let you stray very far, and they're not going to let the Department for the Blind be confused with the Council of the Blind or the Federation of the Blind. That's not going to happen. These are very separate entities. And the consumer groups make that clear to me all the time.
And I understand, in fact, that you have the support for your position on this issue from the Iowa Council for the United Blind.
I haven't heard that formally, so I can't comment on that. I don't know that as a fact. But I want to make the point, Jonathan, that the two major consumer groups here make it clear to me all the time that the Iowa Department for the Blind is not the National Federation of the Blind or the American Council of the Blind. So the potential for senior management blurring with in my mind's eye, I suppose I might cross over from time to time, but I think the safety net is the consumer groups are very clear about the fact that this is a state run entity, and that consumer groups are independent, free, and not at all obliged to do what I ask them to do.
And in the programs that the department runs, are consumers introduced to consumer organizations in equal measure?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely. We encourage participation in both consumer groups. Both consumer groups meet in our building. We announce when the meetings are. If they have other functions, we announce and encourage our students to participate in those. Sure. Absolutely.
Just finally, then, when are you expecting this issue to be resolved? And what will you do if it turns out that you're required to modify the program?
I have no idea, Jonathan, when it might be resolved. I have a sense from people with whom I've spoken that one thing you can count on is that these things take a while. That's about the only thing you can predict with some certainty, is they take a while. We are, of course, sworn to uphold the law, and if we are ordered to make changes, we'll ultimately have to make the decisions that are consistent with whatever the law requires us to do, we would certainly have to rethink what we currently do, and who does it and how we would do it, because as a practical matter, for instance, Jonathan, I have no one on this staff who is a dog guide trainer or knows anything about dog guide training or usage or whatever else. So I guess I would reassure everyone that we're one of the things that I am is sworn to uphold the laws of the state of Iowa and the United States, and certainly I for one am not going to back off from that.
But you would consider the upholding of the complaint clearly a retrograde step for the training of blind Iowans?
I wouldn't care to characterize it as something that would really place a value that says, boy, if it happens, you know, we're awful. The program's gone. I wouldn't characterize it that way.
I appreciate very much the fact that you've come on the show and answered the questions that we've put, and I thank you very much. I hope we can keep in touch as the story develops.
Jonathan, the pleasure is mine, and I hope that if the opportunity comes up, or if it comes to your attention, that you will point out to people that I didn't get your email because I was out of town, and that I wrote back to you early Monday morning as soon as I got back to my computer, because someone told me yesterday that I had refused to not only to be on the show but to answer the email, and I frankly just traveled without a laptop or access to my email, and therefore didn't see it till Monday morning.
Well, we'll make sure we get that in, because I think that's a very important point, and I went to some trouble to be very careful to say that we'd written to you, but we hadn't yet received a reply, and certainly it was never my suspicion that you had refused to reply, and of course the Thanksgiving holiday was right in the middle of this.
I think you and I both demonstrated by our prompt and then aggressive back and forth to get this done that neither of us felt that way.
That's the director of the Iowa Department for the Blind, Alan Harris. You're listening to Blind Line on ACB Radio Mainstream with Jonathan Mosen. The program is recorded today, and so we are unable to take calls, but we will be back live next Sunday at 20 Universal Time, which is 3 Eastern and noon Pacific, and we'll be delighted to take your calls on this or any other topic then, on what will actually be the last Blind Line for 2002. How about that? Let's move on now, though, to talk with Chris Gray, the president of the American Council of the Blind. There were a number of issues raised last week by a couple of board members and others, and I thought it was appropriate to get Chris on the program and explain a few things to us from his perspective as president. Chris, welcome back to the program, and I guess having read some of the material on the Iowa case, would it be fair to say that you are a little troubled by this and the position that ACB appears to be in?
I am somewhat troubled. It's a very complex situation. There are a lot of things pulling us in many different directions at the same time, and while it appears to be straightforward on the surface, I don't believe that it is when you begin to think about the many issues that we must think about as we approach an issue like this.
The GDUI people, I think, from their point of view, it's absolutely clear-cut. A woman has been denied the right to take a course with her chosen form of mobility, that being a guide dog. That's illegal under federal law, that's discrimination, and the ACB should be standing up for this woman's rights. Now, where does the problem lie in all of that?
Well, let's see. Let me say a couple things. One thing I would say is that I believe ACB is standing up with GDUI. We are allowing and supporting GDUI to move forward in the case. We have provided large amounts of staff time and office resource to GDUI, and the board passed a motion in strong support of GDUI to proceed with this matter. At the same time, the board chose not to take the further step of involving ACB directly in the case as a signer on the complaint to the Department of Justice. They did so for a number of reasons. The first reason was that we had had a request from our Iowa affiliate to stay out of the matter, at least for now. It's Iowa's contention that this is a state matter, that it's still tied up in litigation in the state of Iowa, and that it is reasonable for them to request that at least until that part of the litigation is over, or the fact-finding is over, that ACB not take a position.
All right. Well, can I just stop you there and ask you, there it is said that the Iowa Council of the United Blind actually goes further and supports the department's decision to deny Stephanie Doman access to this particular course with a guide dog. Is that your interpretation?
Yes, the Iowa Council of the United Blind supports the policy of the department that Stephanie is fighting in her complaints and is now fighting with about through the Department of Justice.
So even if the matter had been resolved at state level, they still wouldn't be happy with you signing on at a federal level, would they?
They wouldn't be happy, but they also might well view it as a broader issue at that point.
Okay.
Once it goes to a federal level, then it certainly has broader boundaries than the state of Iowa.
And then there was another issue that the board considered in reaching its decision.
Yes. There were issues regarding the complaint itself. And there were those on the board who felt that this particular complaint is primarily attractive to people who are guide dog users, but may very well not be attractive to fact finders who will inevitably make this decision. People who are not members of ACB, people who are not versed in disability at all. There was some belief that many of the statements made in certain parts of the complaint are overstated, stated from the point of view of emotion, not from legal fact. There's nothing wrong with that in one sense, but as part of a legal document, it troubled some board members. A third reason that people expressed concern is that it is not clear precisely what services are being denied Stephanie Doman. And I say this without taking a position one way or another, but in the meeting in Iowa, it was not clear precisely what she'd been denied. What was very clear was she was invited to enroll in the rehabilitation center. She did so, and when she got there with her dog, they turned her away. That's not a very good thing. I mean, to me, that must have been very embarrassing, very humiliating, and it's not supportable. On the other hand, it is said by some that it was an error of bureaucracy, that in fact there were other programs and opportunities available for her in that same department, not within the voc rehab program, but in the same building as the voc rehab program, offered by the same organization, the Iowa Department of the Blind. Services that might have been on a different floor at a different level. And now we get into a very tricky issue. We have a lot of discussion in the regulations about guide dogs not being allowed in facilities, and clearly there would be no question in anybody's mind that that is a violation of the law. ICUB itself was very clear in conversations with me that were it the case that she could not bring her dog into the department, into the facility at all, they would drop their resistance to ACB being involved in the complaint. But because she could go in the facility and possibly get the courses she wanted. And I'm only saying possibly because this is something the fact finders are going to have to dig into and make a decision about. She's not being denied access to the facility, and the issue of programmatic access versus facilities access is going to be a key aspect of this argument. It may not be a fair aspect of it, but it's something that we have to be prepared for. Unfortunately, Gudui has not accepted the reality of the need to be involved in that part of the discussion. I think later on they probably will, and as we progress and things shake themselves out in the case, we can begin to have a more reasonable discussion about that issue in particular.
Don't we have a situation where you've got one bit of ACB, or one affiliate of ACB supporting this issue, another saying, no, we don't support it. You've got National Office, who is providing time and resources to help GDUI, and it seems to be quite an ambiguous and equivocal position. Wouldn't it have been better for the organization as a whole to take one stance or another, at the risk of offending someone, but at least it would be less ambiguous? Or is that just not within the spirit of the way ACB operates?
Well, it has not typically been the ACB way, Jonathan. It sure would be a lot more organized, and it would be a lot neater of a package. But I could cite you many examples where precisely this kind of situation has come up, not in such a public way, but it has come up. The most notable example would be also involving guide dogs, involving the guide dog quarantine in Hawaii. For many years, ACB supported Gudui in their efforts, but not financially, but in many other ways, to lift the quarantine in Hawaii. But we didn't do anything official because the Hawaii Association of the Blind had some very deep objections to the issue. Only over a period of 4 or 5 years did that situation slowly sort itself out. In the board meeting where we made the decision to support Gudui but not be a signer ourselves, Carla Rushable mentioned a situation where the state of Kentucky and our affiliate there was in direct conflict with an official resolution adopted by the organization. And in that case, while the organization did not back down on its resolution, we took a virtual hands-off policy allowing Kentucky to work out its situation as it needed to do. Often there are ways of handling these things diplomatically if you put your mind to it, and that apparently is what was done at that time.
But that makes the Constitution and the Convention a farce, doesn't it, Chris? If the Convention is a supreme governing body, and that's what the Constitution says, and the Convention takes a position, and then affiliates are free to flout that position, then what's the point of a convention?
Well, that troubles me, too. I don't know enough about the Kentucky situation, for example, to comment on it any further than what Carla said in the meeting. The situation was ultimately worked out, and everybody seemed to become satisfied with what happened. We ought to try as hard as we can to avoid direct conflict between affiliates and the national organization. And doing that can be very tricky sometimes. ACB is made up of some very, very headstrong affiliates. Gudui and iCub appear to be two of them.
But wouldn't it be easier? Look, I've had federationists email me, not surprisingly, I suppose, after last week's program. I've had more emails on that program than for a very long time. And a lot of people said to me, you see, this is what we're saying, that democracy is a fine thing, but it's almost verging on anarchy. Isn't it the role of the board to get those two affiliates in a room together, and I understand that has in fact happened, but in the end, if there's an agreement to disagree between those two affiliates, shouldn't the board ultimately arbitrate? I mean, either ACB is a signatory to this complaint and it supports it, or it's not and it doesn't.
ACB definitely needs to do a lot of work with the Iowa affiliate and Gudui, help getting them to sit down with each other and talking with each one, each affiliate individually, to help them understand the other. I was so pleased, for example, in the meeting we had in Des Moines, Stephanie Doman came down, Debbie Grubb was there from Gudui. Everybody had a chance to talk with each other and experience each other as people, as reasonable human beings with differing points of view on a topic held deeply but differently by each group. Being together, talking together, I think was the first step in the process you're describing. But to the broader question of what is ACB's role in that process? Is it our role to make a decision and impose the decision on one affiliate or the other? Or is it our role to stand back and watch events and try and work with each affiliate to rekindle some unity between the two as time goes on? I like to use the family analogy in answering the question. And I think it's helpful in this particular case. Without going into a lot of detail, let me tell you a personal story, because it's the one that I use to think about how to manage this particular situation. Some years ago, I have a very close family. I've got three brothers and a sister, and we've always been close. But some years ago, some difficulties arose within one part of the family, and a situation came up where some family members found themselves in court testifying against other family members. As you can imagine, it was a very awkward and very destabilizing experience for our family. And I think back about it now, and I think about what has allowed us over the 8 year intervening years to come back together as a family, and actually for the first time in those 8 years, in the last 2 years, be together at Thanksgiving or be together at Christmas, all under one roof, speaking to each other, et cetera, et cetera. And the answer is that my parents never took a position, not a public position. They had their opinions, and maybe we knew what they were. But we were all their children, regardless. And over time and over experiences that we came to have, running into one another or whatever, we rebuilt that family environment. And sometimes that's what a national organization is going to have to do as well. It's going to have to recognize that people can be so different and on such a different path that there'll be a time that they simply can't agree. In some cases, it may be that the parent organization has to take a position against one or the other. That's not the case here. In this case, Stephanie Doman's legal needs are being met. Gudui is doing exactly what it should do. It is supporting her, and ACB supports her in that. Iowa is doing what it needs to do. It's trying to come to grips with the issue of guide dogs. There are very few guide dogs in Iowa. It's trying to come to grips with the situation that times are changing and that we have to look at and face up to the issue, not just of facilities access, but program access. They're not in the same space with that as Gudui is. And in the next couple of years, partly through this complaint, we will create some new regulations, possibly some new law, and we'll all learn to adjust to it and live with it. There's no reason why ACB should cause an affiliate to make a decision out of frustration, out of anger, out of being in a different place, to leave the organization. We need an Iowa affiliate. They need a national affiliate. And to force an affiliate, for whatever reason, to contemplate and possibly disaffiliate is a huge step, and it can't be taken lightly. So that's a very long answer to your question, but I hope it helps.
It is, and if I was to try and cynically paraphrase it, it sounds to me like what you're saying is that broadly you support where GDUI is going with the principle of the issue they're fighting, but that there are political risks in Iowa disaffiliating, and of course we know that Iowa has a very strong federation presence because of the history of what's gone on there. Are you seeking to placate Iowa by not taking a principled stand on this?
I don't know if I'd use the word placate. We're seeking to give Iowa the space it needs and the time it needs to grapple with this issue, and for them to watch how the issue is handled in their state and have their own discussion about it, do their own thinking about it, which may not be as quickly as we would like, and hope that we all wind up more or less in a similar place. We're not there right now. I think we will be there in a couple, 2, 3, 4 years. It's very possible, and many believe very likely, that the Des Moines Human Rights Commission and the State Human Rights Commission will find in favor of Stephanie Doman. If that happens, think of the incredible loss, and rather foolish loss, it would have been for ACB to provoke an affiliate to go somewhere else. Just doesn't make any sense.
So has Iowa actually said, if ACB signs on to this, we will disaffiliate?
They have said they would hold an emergency convention for the purpose of considering disaffiliation. So essentially they have, yes.
Isn't that blackmail?
If there were no other reasonable alternative to work with this process, perhaps it would be. But given that there are two actions underway in Iowa, and that GDUI can be the point organization at this time for the action, no, I don't think it's blackmail. I think it's an affiliate expressing concern and a desire for the organization of which they are a member to show them some respect while this process moves along.
Obviously, it was a very difficult decision for the board to reach, and the board took some trouble to get together in a slightly unorthodox way, I guess, because the matter was so pressing. And one of the things about live radio, which we were on last week, was that you never know who's going to call in or what they're going to say. And we did have two board members phoning in last week who strongly disagreed with the stance that the board ultimately took. And I was curious to check with you whether there is any sort of policy within ACB about collective responsibility, that we know that ACB is founded, its very structure is on democracy and openness. But having reached a decision as a board, do you feel that the board ought to be bound to support the collective decision that the board has come to?
Speaking for myself as a board member, I certainly try and do that. I believe that once the board has made a decision, we all ought to do the best we can as board members to support that decision. That isn't to say that a person needs to consider themselves to be entirely gagged or unable to present an alternative point of view. But I do think that one of the worst things that a board can do is make a decision and then begin to have people on that board going and fighting against it once the decision is reached.
Can I ask if you can respond specifically to a point that Brian Charlton made on the program last week, in which he said that a resolution was passed at a convention, he didn't give a specific year, but I think subsequently I learned it may have been the 79 convention, which he believes makes the board's decision not to sign on to the Doman complaint, effectively unconstitutional, because the convention has provided guidance on this issue. What's your response to that?
Well, he's talking about Resolution 7909. It was adopted at the 1979 convention in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And the resolution was read during the meeting the board had last week. And remind me to go back and make a few comments about that meeting, because that might be helpful.
Please do.
resolution itself called upon an organization which is now defunct, called the Affiliated Leadership League of and for the Blind of America, to establish policy for organizations that were members of the league with regard to access of dog guides in member facilities, and that the dog guide be viewed as equal to the long white cane as a mobility aid. Essentially, that's what the resolution says. And I would agree that that resolution does provide guidance to the organization. It provides guidance which says that in a particular context, of a particular time, the organization spoke out in favor of guide dogs being allowed access to rehabilitation facilities. Of course, it doesn't talk about programs. And to a degree, I'm probably splitting hairs to worry about facilities versus programs. But in fact, that is part of the crux of the matter in this case. Regarding the resolution, though, we have to ask ourselves, should ACB consider itself bound by a resolution adopted 23 years ago to have to sign on to a complaint to the Department of Justice on a related issue? From there, ask yourself how often we could find a resolution in all the resolutions ACB has passed since 1961 that would suggest that we would be required to perform a certain action. There are people who interpret things in a fairly specific and strict way, and people who will construe them as liberally as possible. We have a kind of member of the Supreme Court in the U.S., maybe you've heard of them, called a constructionist.
Yes, indeed.
And a constructionist has to find very, very specific language in the Constitution in order to apply it to a particular situation. In this case, I have taken a fairly constructionist view on this resolution, and obviously over a 2-to-1 majority of the board took the same stance toward it. And that is that while this resolution is indicative of the organization's support for dog guides, it in no way binds us or requires us or even suggests that we ought to feel required to sign on to a specific Department of Justice case.
In the previous interview, Alan Harris was very careful not to talk specifically about Stephanie Doman because of client confidentiality, but it seems to me that Stephanie was put on the Comprehensive Adjustment to Blindness course. At least that's what I infer from what Alan Harris was saying. And the specific objectives there appear to be for either newly blinded people who wouldn't have a guide dog anyway, or people who, for whatever reason, need a really back-to-square-one online crash course in blindness skills. Do you support the concept that there is a place for that kind of a course, which should debug guide dogs, that you really need to have some basics in blindness skills, and that in that event you ought to leave the dog at home just for that kind of course?
If it were an ideal world, and all the people who went to these kinds of comprehensive rehabilitation centers had just lost their vision, or were young enough, say, just barely 18 or under, that they didn't have guide dogs, these programs would not face this issue today. And in the rehabilitation model that I grew up in, it was something that one never thought about. People didn't come to rehab programs with guide dogs. It just never happened. Clearly, times are changing, and we have to think about how to accommodate people and how to structure programs to work with people who have guide dogs. The problem that we face is that I don't personally know of any model programs or even any specific programs that do that. One of the things I suggested to the national office that we do in ACB as we prepare to deal with this issue in a rational and long-term way is to find out if there are any programs in this country that would take a newly blind person who went out and somehow got a dog guide and came to that program for their full course of rehabilitation with the dog. I don't know of any, and I haven't heard of the office knowing of any yet. But if we're going to change the rehabilitation model to say that a person can come into a rehab program and use a dog as their first means of travel, we have to have some information and some training modalities to help make that happen. We can't just ordain it and expect it to occur tomorrow.
Well, one of the points Alan Harris made was that they simply just don't employ guide dog O&M instructors at the Iowa Department for the Blind at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Maybe part of what we ought to be doing is asking O&M programs to begin to have a guide dog module as a part of their program. We've got to think of some long-term ways of dealing with this, because we don't really have those strategies available today.
You were going to comment further on the board meeting itself.
Oh, yeah, thank you, I was. There's one technicality that people will be interested in and will probably end up being discussed. We had to have the board meeting very quickly because we had a situation where the executive committee had recommended unanimously that ACB not proceed in this case. We then had the Advocacy Services Committee recommending that ACB should sign on to the case. And then subsequent to that, the Iowa Council asked for a board meeting to have a hearing on the matter. We did not have 14 days to give notice for the meeting because the complaint had to be filed in less than 14 days. And so we had to have a meeting without proper meeting notification. And it was decided, based on Robert's Rules of Order, that we could not suspend the rules with regard to the 14-day notice because those rules are constitutional. And you can't suspend the constitutional rule. You can suspend your own operational procedures, but not a constitution or bylaw ordained requirement. So I think some people are saying, and certainly we use the language in the meeting, that the meeting was advisory in nature and that the board did not make a decision. So I suppose what's going to happen is people are going to hide behind that and say, well, the board really never made a decision, so I'm not speaking against the board because they never made a decision. Fact of the matter is the board had a vote, and the motion to join the complaint lost by 9-4. And while it was not an official board decision, I count it as such in my thinking. And when I called Debbie Grubb the next morning and we talked about the matter, I asked her, did she want to proceed or did she want me to go back to the executive committee? Of course, I hoped that she would proceed, and that's what she did. It was the right thing to do. And we'll just have to wait and see how the rest of it plays itself out. But when you hear discussion about the board meeting being advisory, that's the background for it.
I must say that I found last week that when Debbie was speaking about the board's and ICUB's positions, she took particular care to try and articulate their logic, their rationale. And I suppose that must give you hope that the situation isn't going to get too tense or divisive.
It does give me a lot of hope. Debbie does a wonderful job presenting Gudui's point of view, but doing it in a way which is not confrontational, which is not any more political than it needs to be. I wish you could have heard her in Des Moines. She was just fantastic. And I think that with that kind of presentation, over time, we're going to find our way to a relatively good solution of this matter.
Are you comfortable with the way all this is panning out, or does this raise constitutional issues you would like addressed?
Well, the only issue which is direct that it raises is that it might be wise for ACB to consider a sunset requirement on resolutions. It's not valuable in my mind to have a discussion about how bound or unbound we are by a 23-year-old resolution. ICUB wasn't even a member of this organization when that resolution was passed. In fact, Iowa wasn't a member. Washington wasn't the new WCB wasn't a member. California had not united. Many, many things have happened in those intervening 23 years. And it may not be in the best interest of ACB to be bound by something. What if somebody comes and finds a resolution passed in 1966 that they want to use against our stand for descriptive video? There are resolutions back there that could be used in that way. And that's not in our best interest. So I think maybe we could do something about that, maybe have a constitutional amendment or a bylaw. And other than that, I don't know what else you can do to predict the future. It's difficult to do. Who would have imagined something like this would come up? And yet here we are.
Wouldn't the difference in the descriptive video case be, though, that there are clearly resolutions on ACB's books now which supersede any resolution potentially suggesting that ACB will not support it?
Yes, that's very true, and you got a good point there.
And, I mean, a resolution's on the books until it's rescinded, is it not? So, presumably, that's still ACB's position. And if somebody wants to adopt a different position, it's their role to bring a resolution to the convention floor and therefore have the old one superseded.
That's true. The difficulty is that people often don't know, when you go back so many years, what they might need to supersede or not.
Hmm. So, if a journalist who was not familiar with all of this and the way ACB works phones you up and says, you know, I'm calling from CNN or whatever, what's the American Council of the Blind's position on the Stephanie Doman complaint? What do you actually say?
I would say that ACB unanimously passed a resolution in support of Gudui moving forward with the case in conjunction with and on behalf of Stephanie Doman, that ACB has made significant resource available to our affiliate in this matter, and that we wish for the best resolution possible of the case on behalf of Stephanie.
And is the climate okay between the national arm of the organization and the two affiliates, or is there tension there right now?
I believe the climate is good. Iowa was listened to. They had their say, and for the moment, ACB did not sign on to the complaint or be a part of it. They're feeling positive about that, and they know that we're going to go on talking about the issue, and they're going to go on working on it themselves. I think that, by and large, there's more concern in Gudui about the issue right now, because Gudui wants to be sure that they really do have ACB's support. And I've given Debbie that assurance, and I know that she's passed it back to that organization. And in time, I think that will sort itself out as well.
Well, Chris, I appreciate you coming on the program, and we'll watch developments on this case with particular interest.
Okay.
ACB President Chris Gray, you're listening to a recorded Blind Line this week. We will be back live for our final show for 2002 next week, and we'll welcome your comments then. If you really want to get things off your system, don't forget that there is a Friends discussion list where anyone is free to join and discuss programming heard on ACB Radio and obviously related matters that stem from the programming that you've heard. If you would like to join and perhaps carry on this discussion there, maybe you just have to get it off your chest before next Sunday. Well, you can do that. The subscribe address is friends-subscribe@acbradio.org. That's friends-subscribe@acbradio.org. You'll get a confirmation message back. Just reply to that, and you'll be a part of the team on the ACB Radio Friends list. And that's where Blindline wraps up for today. Thank you very much for your company, and we'll be back next week. Cheers.